Do you remember the 21st night of September? Love was changing the minds of pretenders while chasing the clouds away. Welcome to the Synaptcast, the only podcast dedicated to talking to writers, editors, and publishers about everything except writing. I'm your host, Scott C. Welcome to episode 46 with Gemma Cooper-Novak. It is a raucous interview, true as it usually is on this program. It always goes into interesting territories and conversations. But before we get to that interview, time to update you on some things going on with the place that we are named for, the Sundress Academy for the Arts, SAFTA in Knoxville, Tennessee. The big news coming out of there is the Outspoken Project. We have talked about this multiple times on the program, and it is a worthy cause that I want to bring up one more time for you. The Outspoken Project, if you are not familiar with it, if this is your first time joining us and you have not heard me speak of it, let me explain to you right now. In 2014, the Sundress Academy for the Arts started the Outspoken Project, which seeks to illuminate the struggles of Southern LGBTQIA+ persons and celebrate sex and gender diversity, not only in East Tennessee, not only in the American South, but all over. It is a wonderful program. Each year they run a number of workshops for LGBTQIA+ writers to come in, tell their stories, and work with other writing professionals to bring their ideas to life on the stage in a massive performance in early summer in the Knoxville area. 2016 marks the third year of its running, and it's not too late to contribute to the efforts. If you visit sundresspublications.com/outspoken, that is one word, outspoken, you can find out all the information about the program, about the endeavor, as well as how to submit your work, your voice to the project, show your support for it, as well as find out about ticket information for the show in early summer, which will be coming out in later in the spring here. Ticket information will be available, and when it drops, believe you me, on the SAFTAcast Facebook page, Twitter, and on the show, we will talk about it. But there are also the workshops I mentioned a moment ago. The first one has come and gone, but it is not too late to get in on that action. Again, for more information about it, go to sundresspublications.com/outspoken and learn how you can contribute your time, your talent, your treasure to this wonderful and very necessary endeavor. Now, speaking of the Outspoken Project, that brings us to today's interview. It's a great segue, actually, because, as I said, it's currently in its third year. Well, 2 years ago in 2014, the winner of the Sundress Outspoken Poetry went to Gemma Cooper-Novak, who is on the program today. Gemma is a wonderful person, awesome, awesome person, and it was a delight to chat with her on the program. Truly a good time was had, and I know you're going to enjoy it as we talk about growing up in New York City, traveling about, writers' retreats at home and abroad, and then we find out that the two of us have a deep love and history with live theater. And then it's off to the races as we talk about some of our experiences, swap a few stories, and make our predictions for this year's Tony Awards, as well as what are we most looking for in 2016 when it comes to culture. If you want to get to know Gemma beyond our podcast, go and visit her website at www.gemmacoopernovak.com. That's all one word there. You can find information about her life as a writing coach, her work as an arts educator, as well as her works as a writer and playwright. And don't forget to check out her work at sinnerscreek.com. That is sinnerscreek.commission. However, in your web browser, just type sinnerscreek.com, which is a great source for culture commentary about movies, television, and much more. And one more thing before we move on into the interview. Speaking of workshops, Gemma is hosting a workshop through the Catskills Workshop for Valentine's weekend that deals with writing, love scenes, and yoga. It is going to be an amazing experience, and for information on that and how to get involved with that and be a part of it, visit CatskillsWorkshop.com. That is one word, CatskillsWorkshop.com. I think it might make a great Valentine's Day retreat, a Valentine's Day gift for you, and maybe that special someone. If not, do it for yourself if you have no special someone. I guess that's how it goes. I don't know. I've never been big on Valentine's Day either way, but that's beside the point. Let's get into it. Enough of my talking right now. Let's get right into it. SAFTAcast episode 46 with Gemma Cooper-Novak begins right after our theme song.
you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
All right.
It's good to hear. Good to hear. How's life going?
It's relatively lifelike.
Yeah, better than the alternative, I'm so told by many a bumper sticker.
Indeed.
So welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Well, I like to start off every show with the burning question that is on everyone's mind.
The suspense is killing me.
Given the option, would you prefer a beautiful sunset or an average sunrise?
I think I'm going with sunset.
Why?
I like being indoors in the morning, honestly.
I can understand that. Are you in a cold climate?
I am. I am in Boston at the moment, grew up in New York, lived in Chicago for years.
New York City?
Yes.
Because I'm an upstater boy, so I always have to ask.
No, that's completely legit. I have a close friend from central New York, and for a while she got me in the habit of always specifying city, and I should probably get back to that, honestly.
Yeah, we have to be clear. Where in New York City did you grow up? Whereabouts?
I grew up going between Tribeca in Manhattan and Cobble Hill in Brooklyn every 3 days.
Parents separated?
Yeah.
Which area did you prefer? I'm not asking you parent-wise, I'm asking area. Did you prefer the busyness or the cliche of Manhattan, or did you prefer the outer boroughs?
Honestly, I feel like I'm pretty thoroughly hybridized. You know, you have to understand I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and New York City really was not what it is today in a lot of ways. And, you know, I was an adolescent during the Giuliani era. And a lot of transformations took place in that time. I guess I would almost say that Brooklyn today has a lot of what Manhattan in the 90s had, perhaps. Similar energies.
What do you mean, similar energies?
Well, everybody who goes to New York as an adult goes to New York on some level because they want to be the best. And whether they succeed and what they want to be the best in and how it works is almost not relevant. So there's always that element in Manhattan, even in if you watch old movies, older movies, even from like the 60s, 70s of New York, when of course it was in a completely different incarnation, even from my childhood, you have that sense, even in the scary, desperately seeking Susan type of New York. Or, you know, the original taking of Pelham 123 or whatever. I watch these movies with a very weird focus and fixation. So even when the city's considered dangerous, even when the city's considered marginalized, what have you, there's always this sensation of all these people striving to be the best, which can be wonderful if they have agency to really make it so. I kind of feel like New York today, a lot of it's very much more commercialized than it was when I was a kid. That's an oversimplification, but it is the feeling I get when I go home.
It's shifted, definitely. We've talked to a number of New York writers on the program, or ones who have fond memories in different time periods of it. And yeah, the city mutates about every 15 years, it feels like.
That's legitimate, yeah. Then I wonder where it's going next.
Don't know, but you're right. Late 70s, New York, dangerous place. But then highly creative energies coming out of it in the early, late 70s, early 80s, and then you get the idea that it's somehow the mugging capital of the world, and then Giuliani steps in, as you know, and, well, bye-bye Times Square.
Well, I think the creative energies were always there, dangerous place, quote-unquote, or otherwise. It has never lost its creative energy, I have to give it that, no matter what.
So you're excited to see where it goes next?
Yeah.
I'd be curious, too. So you grew up in New York City. Were you born in New York City?
I was. Lived there straight through till I was 18.
Just once you live there, you don't want to leave kind of thing.
Well, I did want to leave. I did leave. But I thought I would want to come back, and I didn't really end up wanting to come back.
Except for visits and...
Oh, yeah, of course. It's always home. I will always love it. I will never not be a New Yorker. But I don't want to live there now.
Why do you think that is? As you age, you don't want to go back home. Is it just the simple idea that it's home and you don't want to live at home again?
That's part of it, and a lot of it's what I said before. I feel like the city I grew up in is a different place, and if I could move back there, I might. But it doesn't feel like that right now, and I'm not that interested in living in it as it stands.
Fair enough. Yeah, my hometown went to hell, so it's like, I don't want to go home. There's that feeling. It's like, yeah, opposite direction. Nothing there. Don't go home again. So you live there till you're about 18, right? Everything. You take off where?
Chicago.
You went to Chicago next. What was the impetus to go into Chicago, another large city?
Oh, I went to college there, and then I stayed because of the theater community. I was a theater person at the time.
So then how do you find your way to Boston?
Came for the master's degree, stayed for the health insurance.
Fair enough.
I started my master's in 2009, finished in 2010. There was not Obamacare yet. I have a chronic illness. I'm a freelancer. You really would have a hard time living safely anywhere but Massachusetts at the time. Not that tons of people didn't do it, but it was hard.
Well, it's like my mother said when I graduated college. She's like, look, wherever you go, health insurance isn't as important as a paycheck now.
Oh, yeah. No question. And, you know, I got to give it to RomneyCare. It served me well. It's a shame Romney disowned it, but MassHealth and Commonwealth Care are overall extremely good systems.
Don't know. I'm in Florida where it's basically God's waiting room.
Oh, yowza. I believe you.
They send him here. It's the antechamber to heaven.
Huh, that's one way of framing it, yes.
Well, I can't take credit for that. I think The Onion took that title. But anyway, let me ask then, okay, is it just the United States or have you really traveled a lot?
I lived in Ghana for about 6 months in 2009. I studied abroad in South Africa in 2003. We have family friends in France, so I used to go there fairly frequently with my mother. My mother goes every year. It's her best friend. And then I've been to a few other countries in Europe. Ideally, I wanted to hit all 50 states and all 7 continents before I turned 30, but I failed miserably.
What was your ranking at the end?
I think I landed with something like 30 states, 3 continents.
That's still pretty good.
I'm at 38 states now, still 3 continents. I'm going for hitting it all before I turn 40. We'll see how it goes.
It can happen. It can happen.
Here's hoping.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, here's hoping enough money comes in for that, amongst other things.
You never know. You never know what could happen tomorrow.
This is very true. This is very true. You do not.
That's the beauty of things. I got to ask now, the places you've traveled outside of the United States, where has been, like, what's the place that you go back to, like, the first place in your mind of, like, that was amazing?
That's hard. I've been to a lot of awesome places. Right now, I would say probably either Catalonia, you know, technically in Spain. I did a residency there a couple of years ago, and that was pretty bloody incredible. Or Cape Town in South Africa, which is a really fraught and difficult and gorgeous and interesting and intense and weird place. I would go back there.
How did you come to go to Cape Town?
It was a study abroad program. I went to the University of Chicago, and basically, like, they have these really, really intensive and complex core requirements. And one of those requirements is 3/4 of what they call civilization studies. And either you could take a 3/4 sequence on campus, or you could go abroad for a quarter and study the civilization in situ, which was obviously the way better option, so I did that.
It's shorter, but also, I mean, you get the stories out of it.
I mean, it's blastingly intense. It was definitely competitive for the most intense 3 months of my life. I would never trade the experience.
You know, the phrase civilization study, that sounds kind of broad and vague. What does that entail?
I don't know. It's really fraught, honestly, as a concept. It's a little bit anthropological, but sort of like the old school Margaret Mead anthropology, which has its condescending elements and, you know, Orientalist othering elements. But it's also just like really looking into the history of a culture and the history of a place. And that can be incredible and fascinating and awesome.
Was that what you worked on as like your project when you were there, or were you working on something more creative?
No, we all took classes. It was a group that went. We went as a group of 24, I think. Yeah, I think there were 24 of us. And we went with one professor who was South African, but was on a fellowship at the University of Chicago. So he came with us, and then we had a professor in South Africa, and then we had a couple of other guest teachers, a lot of guest speakers. We traveled a bunch. I mean, it was really lucky.
And it sounds pretty intense. You were saying it's like a land of contradictions in a lot of ways, but so many different aspects to examine and enjoy and experience.
Yeah.
So you went to Catalonia in Spain last year for a retreat, and that was like, I could hear the just ecstatic in your voice there. What was so awesome about that one?
Well, that was my first residency. I did it before I did SAFTA. I did it before I'd done any other artist's residency. And I mean, not only was the place just gorgeous, I was right in, losing the name, Montserrat National Park. You know, I could just walk over and hike up Montserrat if I wanted. I did that once. I had a friend in the residency who did it literally every day. Yeah, go big or go home. But also just as an artist, the freedom of a residency is unparalleled. The notion that as an artist who has work in her life other than being an artist specifically, the opportunity to go to sleep thinking about the project I'm working on, wake up, think about the project I'm working on, work on it, not have to shift my attention or focus. That's just incredible. And the opportunity to do it in such a gorgeous and isolated setting was just exponentially more exciting.
Since you mentioned that was your first one, you mentioned also doing one at SAFTA. Have you done many residencies since then?
Five, I think. And I'm doing another one next month.
Yeah, I've never technically done a residency. I mean, I've been to SAFTA many a time, but you were mentioning it's like that's... Is that the real appeal of the residency for our listeners who've never been on them, don't even know what they are, for people like me who've done it kind of limited, sort of, because I didn't go to SAFTA technically for a residency, but kind of did? Mm-hmm. Kind of like a sabbatical for a teacher, only miniaturized.
Yes, and I mean, you work hard. You have to. Usually when I've done a residency, I don't really believe I've accomplished anything until I come back to what I've done later. But at the same time, like, it's spacious. It's spacious in a way that my trying to fit my artistic practice in around the rest of my work and the rest of my life isn't.
Sounds very liberating then, almost like very freeing then.
Yeah. And I mean, at SAFTA and at another residency, I went with a writing partner and we were able to do some really wonderful work together as well as advance our own projects. So that was pretty great. And
are you ever worried when you get the chance to do a residency, are you ever worried that you're going to go to it and just have total brain lock on it and not, and come away with very little?
Yes, because it always takes some time to adjust to being there and to having that space. And there is always a little bit of brain lock, but at the same time, I was lucky that the first one I went on was also the longest. But eventually I realized your brain will calibrate to the space and it will calibrate to as much space as you have.
Both physically and internally.
Oh, if it does it physically, I have no idea. That would be great. Certainly internally.
It calibrates to the fact that, wow, we have a large open space around us.
Yes.
Neat. There's a mountain right over there. There's Montserrat. I could climb it if I wanted.
Indeed. There are some goats. Let us go hang out with them. Let's go SAFTA.
And a very photogenic donkey.
Ah, yes, naturally. Good old Jane.
Ah, yes, Jane indeed. After Chicago, you come to Boston, stay for it and everything. And as I understand it, you are a triple threat when it comes to writing. I don't like to get into writing too much here, but you are kind of a triple threat. Poetry, fiction, and plays.
Yes, and I do some cultural crit as well. That's what I do with my writing partner, sinnerscreek.com.
I don't think we have had I don't know if we've had another playwright on the show before this.
Oh, really? You guys should get on that. Playwright's awesome.
I don't know. I mean, maybe there are a couple, and we just never touched on their work in stage. I don't know, but I know that I think you're the first that we've had that's openly. Yeah, I've done a lot of theater.
That's openly a playwright. Everybody else is closeted.
Maybe, or we just didn't dig deep enough. I don't know. And I don't want to insult any previous guests. I don't want them to think it's like, well, I do plays.
Fair.
I don't know. You know, hey, you know, the show is devoted to not writing.
Both parts. That's fair. Yeah. No.
But I grew up in theater myself.
Oh, great.
Since I was in preschool.
Me too. Actually, before, I was raised in a theater, literally, as an infant.
Really?
Yeah, my mother was a casting director, and she took me to work with her. There's some pretty incredible photographs.
Such as?
You know, me in the casting office in one of those baby seats on my mother's desk in front of the picture, the poster for the original production of For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough, that kind of stuff.
Ah.
Great pictures like that. I got to sing to Linda Ronstadt when I was a year and a half old. I have no memory of this, but it happened.
I wonder if Linda does at this point.
I sang Splish Splash, Splish Splash, I Was Taking a Bath.
That's kind of adorable.
Yeah.
It is kind of adorable.
I was a very charming small child, by all reports.
Do you remember your first time on stage?
My first...
Like, actual performing on stage.
Well, I can remember two. I actually think they happened in the same year. The first was my second grade play. We were studying ancient China, and we had a musical about it called The Chinese Farmer's Tale. And I played the Chinese farmer's wife. And, you know, there were songs to the tunes of Like a Virgin and Blue Suede Shoes and Sounds of Silence and Hotel California. It was pretty weird and wonderful and awful and all the things.
I'm trying now to imagine this in my head.
Welcome to the land of ancient China. Actual thing that actually happened. Now picture a stage full of second graders singing that, and you've got it.
Man, if I didn't hate the Eagles before.
Hey, I think that should make you love the Eagles more, all things considered. I always like things better when they have alternate versions or parodies.
In all honesty, for our listeners who might want to now beat me up, I don't actually have a problem with the Eagles.
Anyway, so the other one was that my mother's friend was an actor, and still is, and she was in a play with a child actor, an off-Broadway play, and the kid got sick, and the kid's understudy also got sick, and my mom's friend said, hey, I know a child. I came to the theater. I apparently memorized the script in about an hour, though I remember nothing. You know, then I'd wait backstage. I had like five lines. Somebody would always go to the store with me, and usually my mother, and get me gummy bears before the performance. And I just sit backstage with my gummy bears. Come on, say my five lines. I think I did three or four performances. Those are my first memories of being on stage, those two.
Did that foster a love of being on stage, you know?
No, I'm not an actor. I'm a pretty terrible actor. In fact, I love writing for the stage. And I love directing, though I don't do that as much anymore. I miss it. And I love teaching theater, but I'm really not an actor. I'm too into everything else that's going on.
When you teach theater, though, do you act out the parts?
Not usually. I'm usually pretty dramatic in theater games, because you have to be. But other than that, no.
I ask because whenever I teach plays and everything, my students, first thing they fear is, are you going to make us perform this? I'm like, no, I'm going to do all the roles because I don't trust you.
That sounds like high schoolers then, yeah?
Well, I teach college, but, you know, it's same mental attitude, that fear of like, wait, we're going to have to perform Shakespeare for the class?
Aww.
Like, no, I'll take all five parts. I'll just give them different voices.
When I was in ninth grade, my friend and I did a scene from Henry IV, Part 1 for English class that way. We deliberately chose a scene that had, I think, six or seven characters, and we did it just the two of us. It was a lot of fun.
Okay, maybe not performance or anything. What drew you to writing for the stage?
I mean, I've got the most, like, saccharine story ever, but I still believe in it. You know, I grew up in a theater. I grew up around theater people. My mother, when I was about six, was teaching me all the different jobs that people had in theater. She was a casting director, so I learned about casting directors, I learned about actors, I learned about designers, I learned about directors. And I said, so the director is the one who makes up the story, right? And my mother says, no, that's the playwright. And I was like, there I go, that's me.
So it was the love of the story and such, of creating your own stories.
Yeah, I want to be the one who makes up the story. I always have.
Now, I got to ask this because I want to know if I'm the only one that ever thought this way. As a child, then, when you would watch toy commercials, did you ever get mad at the children because their stories sucked?
No!
In the commercial.
No, but I like that idea.
Because that was my problem. Like, they'd be playing with it and be like, the bridge has been captured. I'm like, not in my world. That's like just the that's like act one. And no, not all my G.I. Joes and such came home alive.
Yeah, like, we had ongoing epics. My father had a collection he passed down to me and I intensified of little China animals. They lived in cabinets, so we called them cabinetties. And my sister and I and my friends and I, we had these, you know, long ongoing dramas stretching out over months or years. The characters developed, you know, the unicorn and the swan had a rivalry, and all the police force were those animals from the Red Rose tea boxes, you know, the little China animals, what I mean? They were all the police force. Everybody had like a place they went in the cabinet. They all had these weird different relationships and romances. I liked ongoing stories. My sister and my cousin and I also had those storylines with Barbies. We'd come back to my cousin's house the next week, pick out the same Barbies, pick up the story from where it left off.
Now, do you have a desire maybe at the next family reunion or dinner to go after a couple of them and be like, it's been 15 years?
I don't remember the plot points anymore.
It's time for a gritty reboot then of them.
Gritty Barbie reboot. Huh, I could see it.
The years have not been kind to Millicent. I think that was, or was it Skipper? I don't remember who her daughter... No, Millicent was Barbie's middle name.
Yeah, Skipper is like her younger sister.
Kid sister, yeah. So what happened to Skipper when she got old?
Oh, Lord. What happens to any Barbie when they age? I don't even want to think about it.
Possibly heroin, you know. they couldn't deal with the coping of life, so now they're on hard drugs, and they're trying to volunteer at a local mission.
Ouch. And that's painful.
Anyway, back. So it was immediately the stories what brought you into playwriting and such. How do you make the shift then? When did you get the chance to direct finally?
High school. My friend and I, who were still close friends, were both loud and often bossy and dominant people. She and I were talking about the possibility of directing and how interesting we found it, and we decided to start a student directing festival. We had the kind of school that would let us do that. We were very lucky, and that was something we established. And so I started directing in high school and then did a lot of it in college, a little bit of it professionally in Chicago, and then developed a chronic illness, which doesn't really let you have the nightlife required for theater, so I let directing go.
It is a rough life, the theater life, in terms of hours and time commitment.
Yes.
I was once seeing a girl in college and I was in tech week for a play, and she was like, why are you gone 16 hours a day?
Oh, yeah, you don't know unless you know.
Unless you're in the world, unless you're on the inside, you don't understand.
No, and directing is so all-consuming. I loved it. I loved that about it. I loved not being able to think about anybody else and anything else while I was directing. Just all I had was that moment, these people. And I feel the same way teaching. I still feel that way.
Do you get a similar feel when you're writing plays or writing dialogue? You're like, I'm only focused on what this character is thinking and what they will say to this character.
No, it's a little more holistic. I mean, when playwriting is good is similar to when fiction is good for me. I start hearing them. I feel like I'm transcribing rather than creating. I start really just hearing the characters and hearing what's happening and feel like I'm eavesdropping and just have to get it down as fast as I can. But, you know, like with any writing, it's good for maybe 1 hour out of seven if I'm lucky.
I'm assuming that at least a couple of your plays have been performed.
Yes. Not as many as I would like, but I've been out of the world for a while and trying to get back in.
What is it like to go to a performance of something you've done and be there for, say, opening night or even just any of the performances?
It's electric. I mean, being in rehearsal even more so, I think, because there's this sense of mutual generation. You know, this idea that I made it myself and they made it themselves, and in theater both of those things are true. And how cool is that? It's just, it's overwhelming. It's stunning. And then hearing an audience engage with it and having to both be part of that and step out of it is the next level up from that.
When you see an audience react to the things that you've written and now they're alive, literally living in front of you, you see an audience react either with applause or sadness or, you know, whatever the emotion is. How do you restrain yourself from going, sorry about that, I wrote that. Sorry you're crying.
Oh, I'm happy they're crying. I'm awful and alienated enough that I'm thrilled they're crying. I don't apologize.
Or even just to, you know, be like, how do you restrain yourself from being like, yeah, I made that happen for you. Yeah, I did that. That's me.
That's pretty much what I'm doing inside the whole time. I just don't want to distract them, so I don't say it. I don't know if you know of the performance group, the Neo-Futurists in Chicago.
Yes, yes.
So I used to do some work with them, and there's a short Neo-Futurist play from Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind that's called Writer with Chicken Bucket. And at first there's some very dramatic scene playing between two people, and then the lights go down on those people, and the lights come up on a guy with a huge bucket full of chicken. And he's saying, I wrote that! I wrote that! Me! I wrote that! I love to write! I'm a writer! I love to write, and I love chicken! And somehow that's actually always captured the feeling of being in the audience of my own play for me. I could not say why exactly, but it honestly feels like the perfect description.
No, it totally makes sense. When it comes to theater, do you go to a lot of live shows now, or no, just with work and other life commitments, you don't get the chance to?
I don't go to as many as I used to, certainly, but that is what happens when the people doing the shows are no longer all the friends you have.
True.
I'm much more in the poetry community in Boston than in the theater community. So a lot of my priority is for poetry shows and so forth, because those are the people I'm close to. But I still do see a fair amount of theater when I can. Boston has a few small companies, but not nearly as many native as Chicago, relatively speaking. They have a lot of touring pieces coming in as well. So it varies a lot what you see.
When it comes then to writing, reading, and teaching drama, do you find that you have a particular style that you gravitate toward in theater, like particular types of plays such as avant-garde or modernist or more classical restoration style?
Honestly, no. I mean, maybe this is just my luck in having grown up seeing everything, and I'm like literally everything. The first full-length play my sister saw at the age of 4 was Don Juan, if that helps you understand my family at all. And because I really saw everything, I don't feel like I ever developed a preference. I like stuff I think is good.
It's just, it's all good. If it's done well, it's good.
Yeah, and I have really high exacting standards, don't get me wrong, but they aren't really genre or categorically based, I don't think. I hope not.
Yeah, it's not, oh, well, I gotta check out this because it's avant-garde and nouveau. I gotta check this out, but I'm gonna ignore this. No, as long as it's performed well, I don't care what genre you're in.
Well, I'm pretty over the existential crisis for 30-something white dude play, and there are a lot of those.
Yeah.
Other than that, I'll see pretty much anything.
I understand. It's my feeling about, as I've gotten older, I think it's the feeling of mortality and the realization I don't have time to watch crap anymore.
It's for serious. Oh, my lord. I was having a discussion about that with, I think, a guy who's 20 a few weeks ago. Just sort of the fact that I'm now old enough to decide, okay, you know what? I'm not going to see that thing with Leonardo DiCaprio. I don't like Leonardo DiCaprio when he's being serious. I don't think I'm going to like it, however many good reviews it's getting. I'm old enough and experienced enough in my viewing to make that discreet choice, because I don't have all the time in the world. This guy was very offended by this concept as an artist, and he saw it as prejudgment. He saw it as my being jaded and prejudicial. And I'm just like, you know, I get that, and I think I probably would have felt the same way at 21.
Yeah, at 19, I would be, let's go to the video store and get the movie that has an inch of dust on it because nobody's renting this piece of crap.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm like, okay, Netflix, all right, I want to watch something with quality tonight. All right, so, you know, I've actually never seen This is just last night. I'm like, I really could see something with some quality. Let's watch Jackie Chan, Legend of the Drunken Master, considered to be one of his best.
Mm-hmm.
Let's watch something with craft and with skill and with talent behind it.
And? Was it good?
It was probably one of the best I have seen in his catalog. And then, of course, Roger Ebert's like, yeah, that 20-minute fight scene at the end is probably one of the greatest he'll ever be put on film.
Damn, Roger Ebert.
It was excellent.
Here's hoping.
Yeah. It gets a recommendation from me, then. Not that that matters much.
No, it matters.
What made the shift from writing, you know, not abandoning writing plays and such, but moving toward poetry for you?
Oh, no, I always did it all. I've been doing all of this since I was a kid. I would just have a hard time giving anything up. It's more that socially, poetry became my world in Boston. It's just where a lot of my friends are, where a lot of my social life is. And so I'm slightly more focused that way here, but it doesn't mean I'm not still working on all of the rest.
Creative energies have moved.
Not even that. It's really like, I'm really talking literally socially.
So it's not as complicated as it may seem. It's very simple.
Yeah. I have more social spaces where I'm working on poetry, but I still have my own schedule and my own writing days. And, you know, I'm a resident playwright with a queer company here for this year. I did it in the fall. I'm doing it again in the spring with a queer youth ensemble with the Theater Offensive. So I've gotten to focus more on playwriting in the moment in town again, which has been great. And then I have my own projects and my own writing days. And
to return to a moment before, why the hatred against Leonardo DiCaprio?
Oh, I don't think I even hate him. I actually like young Leonardo DiCaprio. I like funny Leonardo DiCaprio. I think his collaboration with Scorsese actually ruined him as an actor. And I wish it had never happened.
I don't know. I'm thinking it's like I haven't seen The Departed yet, much to my wife's chagrin.
It's very good. He's not. Always. Like, serious Leonardo DiCaprio is just vapid. When he's having fun, you have fun. When he's not, you don't.
You know, I think you might be onto something there.
I think I am.
Now that I'm thinking of all the roles I've watched him in, it's like, no, I have trouble with him when he's trying to be stone-faced and, like, serious man.
Yeah, I would offer that his best performance is Catch Me If You Can, and you can see the joy. I mean, to be fair, I haven't seen Wolf of Wall Street, where he was playing a character I am not particularly interested in or caring about, but somebody who was having fun. So, you know, I could imagine that was a better performance than many of his others, but he also just got boring over the last bunch of years, so I'm not sure he could have gotten it back.
I still have my issues with a few of his films. Titanic is its own whole bowl of wax.
I'll tell you two things about Titanic. Number one, if you turn the sound off, it's really good. James Cameron is a visual artist, and if he would stop pretending he was anything else and, you know, let other people write his scripts, I bet his movies actually could be great. I watched Titanic at 16, thought the script was atrocious, because it is, actual fact, but I watched it on a plane with the sound off. Really good that way.
I will agree with you. It is beautiful visual.
Mm-hmm.
Gorgeous film. Yeah, script and a lot of changes in it. Historical accuracy issues.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know my way around the history very well. I do know that Kate Winslet in that movie did fully wake me up to the fact that I'm interested in women, and I'm not the only person I know for whom that was true. So, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I'll put myself in that category as well, maybe. And actually, I don't mind her performance that all in that film either.
Kate Winslet's a brilliant actor. She brings it. I think she's been making bad choices lately. I don't know whose fault that is. I don't know if it's her or her agent or what. But she still brings it even to really bad stuff. And I like that in her.
In that sense, then, I feel almost she's in that category that, like, Natalie Portman is in.
I hate Natalie Portman, sorry.
That's okay. But But among those actors and actresses who try to bring their A game to even the worst stuff.
Yeah, I would give that to her. I would not give it to Portman, but I hold a lot against Portman. I saw her in The Seagull in Central Park in 2001. And the rest of the cast included Meryl Streep, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Kevin Kline. Natalie Portman pretty much single-handedly destroyed the entire thing. The play falls apart if you can't understand why people are so compelled by Nina. And I just think she's another actor who has nothing there.
Wait, that's a hell of a lineup there in terms of the supporting cast there.
Oh my god, I mean, I slept overnight in Central Park to get those tickets. Friends and I, we had a blanket set up on the street outside Central Park. We slept in shifts. I was 19, it was amazing.
Would you say that is one of the best overall live performances experiences you've ever had with theater?
Honestly, no. I've had a lot of really great live performances experiences. Live performance experiences, pardon me, with theater. But it's one I'm very glad I saw.
If you had to pick one, besides seeing your own work performed, just one where you were a spectator, what do you think would be the most amazing performance you've seen?
The most amazing performance by an individual or the most amazing play?
We could go either way.
One production that I know is always going to stay with me is a production of the Threepenny Opera at ACT in San Francisco when I was 17, I think, so 1999. And B.B. Newworth was both Jenny and the Ballad Singer. Malcolm Getz was McKeith. And Anika Noni Rose, before anybody knew about her, I think she was still a student or had just recently stopped being a student, was Polly Peachum. And it was the Michael Feingold translation. Now, most people, the Bobby Darin, Mac the Knife, and what have you, that's the Mark Blitzstein translation, which has its merits, but is also really heavily Baudelaireized. And Brecht wasn't writing Baudelaireized lyrics. He was writing really explicit and abrasive and direct material. And the Feingold translation really plays to that. And so I knew the play from the Blitzstein translation. I'd been listening to it since I was a kid. But hearing these lyrics more aligned to how Brecht wrote them, I mean, I don't speak German, so I don't know for sure, but it's definitely much rawer and closer and much more in keeping with what I know of Brecht.
And you've got, B.B. Newworth and a couple of the other names you mentioned. That's a hell of a lineup, too.
Yeah, no, I mean, B.B. Newworth was mind-blowing, and, Anika Noni Rose, that is one of the best vocalists of our generation right there on stage.
Ooh, yeah. So,
but, it's a ferocious musical. It's a really angry and forceful and thoughtful and disturbing musical, and this production really got that, and this translation really got that. And in terms of how we understand the world we live in through storytelling and through story and through performance, I think that's one of the ones that will always stay with me.
I'm going to have to look into it a little bit. Unfortunately, my knowledge of Brecht is only about one or two plays.
Yeah, well, I mean, some of them are terrible, to be entirely fair. Like St. John's Stockyards, you can skip. You're really fine.
Yeah, I've hit a couple of the big ones like Mahogany and such.
Yeah. I love Vile, too. Mother Courage is worth spending some time with. Caucasian Chalk Circle is worth spending some time with.
I will have to maybe take some time off in the summer months. Yeah, if that's possible. to bone up on my Brecht a little bit. I knew something was wrong with me, but I knew something was off with me in college when I was exposed to it. And I was like, actually, I get this stuff. This is kind of makes sense to me.
Yeah, no, I mean, and if you've got college students now, he's worth teaching in this day and age, especially. He's really worth teaching.
It's like I've often said, it's like I knew something was wrong with me in high school when I was the one in my class going, don't you understand what Shakespeare is saying here, though? How can you not understand this? I often say it's like in Macbeth, it basically boils down to it's like Pringles. Once you murder somebody, you can't stop doing it.
Fair enough. Oh, Sleep No More would be another really forceful theatrical experience. The immersive very loose performance adaptation of Macbeth that it started here in Boston. It moved to New York. I think it might actually still be running in New York. I think the theater company is Punch Drunk, but I really could be wrong about that, and I'm going to be really upset if I am.
Let me ask you real quick here. Is like, since you're kind of up on culture, you're up on movies and theaters we've been talking here, just out of the first month of 2016, what are some of the things that you're really looking forward to in 2016 in terms of, you know, mainstream culture, the arts, theater, etc.?
Oh my goodness. I mean, in terms of the dialogue I have on Sinner's Creek, I'm looking forward to How to Get Away with Murder coming back. What else am I looking forward to? You know, I feel like I don't know what's coming, actually.
Well, we've got things like, now that I think of it, now I'm stumped too. The only one that's on my mind is like, wait, there's another Star Wars film coming out in December.
Oh, you mean the stuff that already happened?
No, there's another one coming out in next December as well.
Oh, I thought it was the December after.
Doing one Star Wars Rogue Squadron, Rogue One.
Oh, all right. Yeah.
It's going to start, this is what's going to happen now that Disney has their hand in it. You're going to get a Star Wars movie every single year from here on out.
And lo and behold, people are going to go to them.
On one hand, I'm like, yay, but at the same time, I'm like, you're going to overdo it, and they're no longer going to be special to us.
I know what else I'm looking forward to.
Mm.
The Birth of a Nation, the movie about Nat Turner that is reclaiming that title. The actor, he was apparently in Beyond the Lights, which I didn't see yet, but he literally said, I'm not acting again unless I can play Nat Turner, and he got this made. And it's him, and it's Asia Naomi King from How to Get Away with Murder, and I'm just very excited about that. That's the other thing I can think of that I'm really looking forward to.
It's like out of nowhere almost, in a way, like Hamilton just suddenly, wait, everybody's talking about this.
I am going to see Hamilton this spring, so I'm excited about that too, but
that counts
as my experience, not as like the pop cultural phenomenon of this year. It's the pop culture phenomenon of last year.
I think that's going to clean house at the Tonys this year.
Oh, yeah.
Just feeling it. I'm just feeling it now.
I mean, you got to feel for anybody else who happened to open this year.
You can always tell when it's going to happen. Like, Rent demolished everybody. You could tell it was going to happen.
I mean, like, the Rent phenomenon is the closest to the Hamilton phenomenon, all things considered.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's true. Every now and then there's the big hit, and then there are years where you're really not sure.
You know, now that I think of it, of all the award shows that are come out at this time of the year, I'm like, the Tonys are like the one that's the most, like, honest in a way.
Honest how?
In the sense of, like, the big hit is the one that is the best versus, like, oh, this is just, here's a bunch of, you know, good performances. I don't know. I'm going to have to think about this one. Huh. I'm going to think about it. There's something, like, almost comforting in the fact that, like, you go into the Tonys and you're like, yeah, I know who's going to win pretty much this year.
That's interesting. I mean, you know, I don't know that you can always rely on it being the best, but, you know, the Hamilton soundtrack's certainly the best. I haven't seen the production yet, so I can't speak to that. But, you know, like, obviously, if Lin-Manuel Miranda didn't win, it would be a travesty. There's no question. But he will, so we really don't have to worry about that. You're right.
It's like there's no real betting involved, so to speak.
The stakes are completely unrelated to anybody outside of the room. Probably more so than the Oscars, or, I mean, really all the award shows are just an industry honoring their own. And that's the only reason the awards matter, is because they reflect the tenor and feelings of the industry, and therefore what's going to get made within that industry. That's why Oscars So White is a big deal. But there is really always something more self-contained about the theater community.
From my experience, and it does have an insular feel, but in it, insular but not suffocating, not claustrophobic.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of why I'm going with self-contained rather than insular. Like, it can feed on itself if it so chooses, and that can be incredibly frustrating. And certainly lead to a certain level of delusionality about the actual quality of the work you're producing. But at the same time, there is this very potent sense of all being in it together that I don't get the impression exists in the film industry. I've never worked in it, so I don't really know.
It's just soulless. That's all I know.
I mean, I think it's more complicated than that. My sister's in the industry, so, like, I want to be thoughtful about it.
Okay, well, we'll say that they may have a little more heart, but I will just say that the music industry is soulless and heartless. We'll leave it at that.
I mean, like, the highest echelons of any industry suck, you know? That's just inevitable.
You know, anyway, what has happened to this hour that we have together? It is almost up.
Oh, my goodness. So it is.
We've been chatting here about theater, completely lost track of things. It's like, wow, there's so much to talk about, but it's always nice to chat with somebody who can understand and talk theater and talk shop with me.
It's true. It is a world when you're not in it completely. It's nice to come back.
It is. I hadn't been in a play for a long time, and then I was asked to do one a few years ago, and in my dressing room on opening night was a card, and inside it just said, "I'm so glad you found your way home."
Aww. Yeah, I mean, I think I had that moment this fall. I was working on the play for the Queer Youth Ensemble with the Theater Offensive, and I was having a play done in a short play festival at the same time. And there was an energy to it that is genuinely unique and that I had genuinely forgotten.
Before we wrap this up, I want to take a couple minutes here. What have you got? You've mentioned this work you're doing in Boston with queer theater and everything. What else have you got coming up? And, you know, I believe you have a writing workshop coming up. You mentioned a retreat.
Yes. So I'm working with a partner, Sarah Doe Osborne, and we're running a retreat over Valentine's Day weekend, Crafting the Love Scene. And there are special discounts for lovers. The website is catskillsworkshop.com. You got to register real soon. And then I'm going to be running another intensive retreat for people writing business plans up here in Boston, but that's not till the end of May. That's called Innovation and Inspiration. I'm a writing coach and teacher, so a lot of what I'm doing up here is very focused around that work. I'm going to be in a very silly poetry slam called the Schmaltz Slam at the Cantab in Cambridge next week on February 10th, which is my birthday.
Happy early birthday to you.
Thanks. Still working on the Diablog Cultural Crit site, Sinner's Creek. Then I've got this play with the Theater Offensive in the spring. I know I'm missing a couple of publications. I have two poems coming out in Iron Horse Literary Review this spring. I have a piece in Shark Pack Poetry Review Annual, and I probably should have written all of this down.
It's safe to say you are busy and quite visible out there. Where can the folks, you know, find more information about you? You mentioned being writing coach and everything. Where can folks find you online if they want to get in touch with you, check out some of your work, etc.?
GemmaCooperNovak.com, GemmaCooperNovak. That is my main spot. And then all the websites I mentioned before, Cat Skills Workshop, Sinner's Creek, and Innovation and Inspiration.
Cool. And you're on the Facebook and on the Twitter?
I am. I do not tend to friend on Facebook people I have not met, but you can absolutely follow me on the Twitter. That's Gemma Supernova is my Twitter.
Gemma Supernova.
Yes.
Hopefully, you know, some people check out your work because I've had the opportunity to via your website and everything, and it is spectacular. Gemma, it has been a pleasure having you on the program.
Thank you so much, Scott. I've really had a good time.
Oh, we'll have to have you back sometime. Feel free to drop by anytime. We'll chat more theater, and who knows? We'll have to maybe commiserate post-Tonys and discuss what happened.
Absolutely. I'd love to.
Have a debriefing of it.
Sounds terrific.
All right. Well, you take care, Gemma. We'll talk to you soon.
You too.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.